This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
BBC World Service, I'm Mike Williams. Welcome to The Why Factor. This week, bullying. What is it? Why does it persist? And how should we handle it?
Oh my God, that's all I heard every day for months. Like literally 3 months, everybody lard ass and, you know, boom bub. Every time I walked somewhere, it was just this horrible, horrible thing where it's just like, I would just cry every day having to go to school. I did not want to go to school. It was just the worst place in the world for me.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never happen.
We moved from Bergen in Norway to Trondheim in Norway. Incredibly different accents. And every time I spoke, the other children would laugh. I felt excruciatingly humiliated, and I wanted to just fall through a big hole in the ground. But no doubt they genuinely found it funny.
Humans have lived with bullying for a very long time, according to the anthropologist Chris Bohm. He's director of the Goodall Research Centre in Southern California, where they examine the members of the biological family Hominidae, the great apes, the chimpanzees, bonobos and gorillas of Africa, the orangutan of Asia, and the last member of the family, the humans.
The shared ancestor that humans have with chimpanzees and bonobos was an animal given to a great deal of domination and, of course, submission. Where you have domination, you need to have submission or else you'll have strife. And this ancestor had alpha males, and alpha males, by definition, are big bullies. Alpha males get their own way with respect to food sources. They also get their own way with respect to mating opportunities. And this, we can assume, was happening for many millions of years, actually, because that ancestor lived about 6 million years ago. And through the ages, we have always had bullies.
So our ancient ancestors had learned how to bully and be bullied. But there came a time when the early humans learned something new, something that forced the bullies out of business, for a while at least.
Something happened about 250,000 years ago until about 12,000 years ago that changed things. And that was that humans began to hunt large ungulates like zebras and antelope. And they had to cooperate to do so because their weapons were rather primitive. And in doing so, they had a problem. And that was they did not want alpha males to be dominating the carcass after it was killed. So the thing that everyone else did was to start killing alpha males. People lived this egalitarian lifestyle in which bullies simply were not tolerated.
Through prehistory, the bullies rise, then fall, as our ancestors discover a need to cooperate. But then, Chris Bohm says, humanity made another discovery, agriculture. We settled down in the landscape and our numbers grew. These days, we call it civilization. And this new type of human society required chiefs and kings and rules and laws. There were new opportunities for the bullies to rise again.
The typical tribal society, that would be a bunch of farmers who live in small communities, are egalitarian just like hunter-gatherers. However, as their populations increase, often enough they form what we call chiefdoms. All of a sudden, you have chiefs appearing for a very good reason. And that is that when you start crowding a bunch of people together, their conflicts become very devastating. And you need to stop the conflicts before they become fully developed. And that's what the chief's job is.
I'm Helena Goldbug. I'm author of Reclaiming Childhood, Freedom and Play in an Age of Fear, and I teach developmental psychology.
What is bullying?
Well, bullying is something that's incredibly difficult to define. Now, we tend to come up with the same definition that's often used in academia. It has to be something that's intentional. It's intentional on the part of the perpetrator. It has to involve some kind of power imbalance. So it's not an argument between equals. And it's something that's repetitive. So it's not a one-off rage by one person against another. It's repetitive.
And when you say intentional, what's the intent?
The intent is to cause harm. It has to be intentional to cause harm, which can be psychological or physical. And that's where the difficulty is, I think. Because if you can imagine, how do you research bullying? If you're in a court of law and you're going to judge whether there was intent on the part of the accused, it involves reams of evidence and days of deliberation. So it's incredibly difficult to research bullying in terms of the prevalence of bullying, the long-term effects of bullying, and whether or not anti-bullying campaigns work. Words do hurt, but it very much depends on how you interpret it.
I think that, perhaps, back when I was growing up, kids were left too much to their own devices to just sort of deal with bullying by themselves, and we grown-ups didn't recognise the different ways that children can be pretty malicious and vicious to each other. But I do think there is a new problem, which is what I call the misdiagnosis of bullying, this sort of sense that whenever children do anything that's not nice to each other, the grown-ups have to step in. And that I think, is new and problematic.
Tim Gill is a writer and researcher. He's the author of a book called No Fear, Growing Up in a Risk-Averse Society.
I think there's a growing anxiety about almost everything to do with children and childhood. And we grown-ups find it very easy to focus on, the what if, what might go wrong, the terrible things that happen to some children. And bullying is one arena in which that happens. And our well-meaning adult concern to protect children can actually take things too far. And we start to deny them the very kinds of experiences that actually help them learn how to deal with different social situations. And I think that's going on with bullying. I just want to be really clear. I'm not saying that, we need to let children learn how to deal with bullying. I'm saying we're misdiagnosing more minor spats, arguments, fights, fallings out between children, labelling it as bullying and then stepping in too soon. And that's happening, I think, in quite a lot of children's lives. Bear in mind also another big change between your childhood and our childhood and the childhoods of children today. We were free-range kids, I'm guessing. We had a lot of freedom, and that's not the case for children today. And many children, in effect, reared in captivity. So we need to find out ways to give them some freedom, some opportunities to take some responsibility for themselves.
So you think there's an overreaction?
I'm careful about this because bullying is a problem, and we know there are too many stories of children whose lives have been destroyed by bullying. We need to figure out ways to deal with bullying effectively. And effective measures mean sorting out the wheat from the chaff. It means sorting out the real problems, the real dysfunctional relationships, the children that are really harming other children and the children that are really being harmed, and focusing our efforts on that, not wasting time on mundane, everyday children being children. Now, that's not always easy, but I think it's absolutely essential.
My name is Shane Koizan. I'm a spoken word artist, born in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, Canada.
Shane, can I try a phrase on you? It's this: sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me.
It's garbage. Garbage. The scars that are left in people's psyches because of the things that they're called stay with you for a long, long time. They're with me today. I still have triggers today. So for me, art just became an outlet, or spoken word became an outlet where I was able to sort of, and through the years, I've been very uncomfortable with myself physically. The people at school made sure that I, grew up that way, and I'm still affected by it today. There's just, I am not comfortable with myself physically at all in the slightest. But because of that, I've kind of overcompensated emotionally, where it's, I'm very comfortable with a certain level of emotional nudity where I'm able to stand in front of a room full of strangers and sort of espouse my story or my feeling, my thoughts or opinions.
There's so many of you. I'm not the only kid who grew up this way. surrounded by people who used to say that rhyme about sticks and stones. As if broken bones hurt more than the names we got called, and we got called them all. So we grew up believing no one would ever fall in love with us, that we'd be lonely forever, that we'd never meet someone to make us feel like the sun was something they built for us in their tool shed. So broken heartstrings bled the blues, and we tried to empty ourselves so we'd feel nothing. Don't tell me that hurts less than a broken bone. That an ingrown life is something surgeons can cut away, that there's no way for it to metastasize, it does.
It always starts so small with whether it's name-calling or teasing or things like that. But then gradually, as things go along and people realize, you know, they can get away with possibly more, they'll try to get away with more. And eventually they will get away with more until it, you know, it becomes something where people are starting to cross certain lines into, you know, bullying almost becomes too cute of a word at some point where, you know, you have people really crossing the line into assault. People say, you know, bullying is just part of growing up. Okay, well, that might be true, but I think we're starting to evolve past certain things where we don't need to do that anymore. So, you know, and just the suffering that you see from kids that are going through it. And granted, it's much different now than it was during my time where, you know, there's no safe haven anymore. Home is not a safe place. You've got cyberbullying and, you know, where, like, I mean, you know, your tormentors are able to enter your home via the World Wide Web. So it's just getting a little out of control.
One day, Shane got lucky. The family moved to a new town. There was a new school for him, maybe a new life. New kids in class, the possibility of friends.
And I noticed, you know, this group of kids that were, you know, sort of off to the side, and one of them broke away, and I thought, oh, this is it. Somebody's going to come say hi or something, and, you know, slams a piece of celery down on the desk, and he says, it's called dieting, fat sack. And at that point, I just, it happened so often, I was like, I cannot do like 3 more years of this. And so just got into a really big fight at that moment, lost my temper completely, and, you know, ended up hurting this kid really, really bad. And then being called down to, you know, the counselor's office and, you know, my grandmother's there as well. And, you know, them saying, you know, like, oh, your grandson is a bully. I was like, I remember laughing. I remember just being like, are you kidding? Like, how could you, you know, how could that be? Like, I mean, ended up becoming this thing that I hated. But it became one of those things where it's like, okay, I'm going to embrace this because this is obviously what they want out of me. And if it's enough to get them to leave me alone, so be it. And so I started to feed that reputation where, you know, and not at any, I didn't target anybody specifically. It was just sort of, you know, whoever happened to be there.
The academic definition of bullying requires an imbalance in power between the perpetrator and the victim. You need a hierarchy. Children create a pecking order in the playground. But what happens when they grow up? Darren Treadway from the State University of New York has studied bullying in the workplace.
We'd like to see people who bully actually get lower performance ratings. But since we all know that bullying continues to persist, there has to be some bullies who are doing well. Our particular research looked at whether or not bullies who are politically skilled, people who are able to read their work environments, people who are able to understand the motivations and the weaknesses of other individuals, are actually able to leverage their bullying behavior to get higher performance ratings. And what we saw is that for people who are politically skilled in organizations, their performance ratings continue to go up the more they bully.
Is there an archetype, a model for the successful bully? What do they look like?
Well, I in terms of looks, if you're looking at personality, I think what we know from a successful bully, at least from the research we have, is that those individuals are capable of understanding the contextual environment within which they work. And one of the interesting things about people who are politically skilled is that when they talk to you, they come off as authentic, even if they may not be. So you can think of politicians. And the idea that someone like Bill Clinton could make you believe that he cared for you, whether he did or not, is irrelevant. Well, if you translate that political skill to the bullying context, when somebody tells you that everyone's laughing at you because you're short or that your work is subpar, you're going to believe it, even though it may or may not be true.
Is there a danger that we misdiagnose bullying, that there are lots of conflicts in life, and yet this word, bully, is something that, as we've discussed, is something that is very powerful? Don't you think there's a danger of lumping all discord under that one term.
I absolutely believe you're right. And I think the difficulty in the research, if we take something like abusive supervision that we've been talking about, which is a form of bullying, it's bullying coming directly from your supervisor, and we look at whether or not, you know, somebody's tough, aggressive behavior happens to be, you know, what we might call tough love or what we might call abusive behavior or abusive supervision, it all is in the eyes of the target. So at the end of the day, if the target feels as if they're being bullied, the corporation needs to make sure they're addressing that feeling. If you're the supervisor who your subordinate says that they're being bullied by you or abused by you, while you may not feel you're doing that, it's your responsibility as a communicator to make sure that they're getting the accurate perception of your behavior. But the idea that we're going to eliminate bullying or the perception of bullying, real or perceived, in organizations or in schools, it's just not going to happen. It's a way that people try and gain power, try and achieve dominance. What we can do, though, is try and make our workplaces more civil.
It's not an easy thing to face the person tormenting you and say explicitly, you are a bully. It's a powerful word.
And that's the reason we try and label it. Like you said, it's a loaded term, and being known as a bully is a stigma that nobody in a corporation wants.
As a child, Shane Coisan was bullied and then became a bully. He used his size and the threat of his rage to defend himself. These days, he uses his voice to break the silence in which bullies thrive, to break their power.
They have to be wrong. Why else would we still be here? We grew up learning to cheer on the underdog because we see ourselves in them. We stem from a root planted in the belief that we are not what we were called. We are not abandoned cars stalled out and sitting empty on some highway. And if in some way we are, don't worry, we only got out to walk and get gas. We are graduating members from the class of we made it. Not the faded echoes of voices crying out names will never hurt me. Of course, they did. But our lives will only ever always continue to be a balancing act that has less to do with pain and more to do with beauty.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.